The views expressed in this interview are those of the individuals and do not reflect the official policy or position of the U.S. government, the Department of Defense, the U.S. Navy, or the Naval Postgraduate School. Welcome to the Trident Room, brewer of stout conversation, unfiltered and on tap.
Part two of a two-part episode.
Welcome back, friends. This is your host, Elena Youngblood, and I am here today with one of my best friends, one of my mentors, and the godfather to my new daughter, Commander Retired Bobby Jones. Let's go over a little bit about your career. You were a graduate of the Naval Academy, year 2001. You were the deck officer above USS Germantown and USS Harper's Ferry, fire control officer above the USS Normandy, and the weapons and then combat systems officer aboard USS Steedham, where I met you, good old DDG 63. After that, you were the executive officer of USS Anzio, also Coastal Riverine Squadron 4, and then moved up to be the commanding officer of Maritime Expeditionary Security Squadron 4 and Task Group 56.7. You also served non-deployment or military adjacent things of admissions counselor at the U.S. Naval Academy, UN peacekeeper in Liberia, war games planner for the Missile Defense Agency, and executive assistant to the commander for Military Sealift Command. You have participated in Operations Enduring Freedom, Inherent Resolve, Noble Eagle, and the recovery of 10 detained American sailors near Farsi Island. Now that you say that you're looking back on different experiences, did your years in uniform strengthen your faith in America or complicate it?
It actually strengthened it a lot. As a matter of fact, I'll take it a step further. It's the only thing that's giving me hope right now. We are probably the most partisan we've been, definitely in this generation. Easily since the Civil Rights Movement, and then there are people who argue since the Civil War. That's how divided this country is. The military, the Navy in particular, and I say that not to knock the other branches of service, but the Navy in particular gives me hope, because there's something about the concept of throwing 400 people, 5,000 people on a ship, and you see the same people every day from all walks of life, every day for a deployment, and yet you do all of these ridiculously awesome things. That shows me that we can move past a lot of these things that we think are separating or divisive. More importantly, we can look at all these differences and use that as a way to expand our abilities, because we come together and use each one of those perspectives and backgrounds and be great. What I see in civilian society in America is we try to exploit those differences and create these tribes. Guess what? China doesn't give a damn about your tribes. They think it's hilarious because it gives them a competitive advantage. Russia thinks the same thing. We fight with ourselves more than the rest of the world wants to fight with us. That's a problem. Something about going through boot camp, everybody getting their butts kicked, or going through a plebe summer, or indoctrination, ROTC. Something about that process that starts you breaking down the walls and coming back together is phenomenal. I'm to the point where I honestly believe that every civilian should have 2 to 3 years of service, whether it's in the military, government service, local service, something that forces you to break down these walls that you have. And see, me and this person got a lot more in common than I thought. And most importantly, what does it mean to sacrifice for other people and the greater good of your country, your nation, your community? The Navy gives me hope for the future. It really does. At the same time, the Navy also allows you to see the world. You can be in the Air Force 20-some years and never leave the continental United States. Chances are very low that happens in the Navy. When you're in the Navy, and I say this being very serious, you are an ambassador for the United States. You have to be exposed to different cultures when you pull into different ports. You have to see the world beyond your doorstep. And so the combination of all that is what gives me hope. And I'm glad I was part of it for whatever limited amount of time I was in.
You transitioned from military operations into what I'm going to call the political and social media strategy sphere. Was that actually a smaller leap than most people assume?
I think it's a small leap, and I'll tell you why. My generation served in a very unique time. The global war on terrorism forced military personnel, military officers in particular, to take on roles that they classically had not really taken on. For example, you look at what happened in Afghanistan. State Department famously rebelled against Condoleezza Rice. They didn't want to deploy to Afghanistan and Iraq, right? So You had a lot of junior officers, captains, army captains, that were walking around provinces in Afghanistan, being State Department, being military, being force protection, all of this. And so when I look at my career, I'm walking on the ground like an army soldier. And then I do the Riverine thing, which is a completely different thing than most of the Navy. But at the same time, did the classical Navy tours, etc. But I got to basically circumnavigate the world, different places. And I look at it, and it gives you this breadth of experience. Unbelievable breadth of experience. And you come home, you get done, you retire. And then you turn on the news, and you see media people talking about military operations that have no clue what they're talking about. They can't even put the initials correct on the rank of the people talking. They are so removed. And so when someone asks you your opinion on something, you're like, well, they're wrong, and here's why. This, that, this. I served here. I did this. I'm telling you this is how it works. This is what's going to happen. And then when it comes true, they're like, oh my gosh, you're Negro Damus. You have predicted the future. Which is not even, it's just you have the experience of doing it, right? And so what happens is, let me back up. Because we had the draft for the longest time in the 20th century, everybody had somebody in their family that had served in the military. Once the draft went away in 72, 74, whatever year it was, that separation between the military and civilian world started to be formed. By the time we went into Afghanistan, Iraq, it was wide. In 2026, it's a canyon. And so you have military people that have this experience that civilians cannot relate to. And yet the news dominating the day right now is military action all over the world. So you have this experience. You try to convey it to people. You try to break it down where they can understand it and hopefully inform them. But that's hard to do in a space where you have misinformation. You have opinionated personalities. You try to just tell the truth as you see it based on your experience. That has not been hard. What has been hard is trying to make it digestible for people that cannot even relate to what you did in your career or what you do currently. And I'm sure every service member that's out there trying to explain this to their friends back home, they're like, I have no idea what you're talking about. I know I'm paying $8, $9, $10 for gas. That's all I know. So that's been interesting.
How similar would you say information warfare is to modern political media?
I think modern political media is a facet of information warfare. I think it's something that the military has been dealing with for generations that now the political sphere has officially adopted. What's fascinating to me is how slowly the rest of America has identified what's happening, especially with AI coming into the picture, this, that, and other. It is very difficult for people to determine what they're actually seeing, if that's accurate, if that's true. And we have now created such a digestible soundbite culture where, okay, that person says something for 2 minutes, it trends millions of views, that must be right. No, not necessarily. You have to do the research. And the problem with this is when you're looking in your phone and things are dynamic and it's changing, you don't know if you're being told the truth or not. The one thing I will say that other societies have a higher political IQ than what we're currently dealing with in the United States. I don't think that's something that can't improve, but I think it's true. When you go to Japan, you go on the trains, people are reading newspapers, this, that, and the other. They have a very high journalistic standard before something gets published, all of that. Here, anybody can say anything, and if it resonates with the right group, it'll trend, and then next thing you know, it will be truth. We have seen someone make up a story, the White House will pick up that story, and then retweet it and say it's gospel. And next thing you know, people are acting like it's policy. We live in a world where we don't know if we get orders from Truth Social, Twitter, or official means now. That's a mixture of all of that. And so when the media is sitting there trying to tell you what you need to know, they don't even know what the source of information is, where they should be looking or listening. That's a fundamental problem. It injects chaos. The media amplifies the chaos. People believe what they're hearing, which is chaotic. And you, as the service member, who A, has to kind of be quiet about everything, can't really vocalize your opinion, but B, are you getting ready to deploy? Are you going to extend on deployment? Da, da, da. And this is coming from Twitter. So that right there is warfare. Because psychologically, you're like, man, we getting extended again? Are you serious? Which has happened. We've seen it. And so it's very important that people find trusted sources of news. It's very important that, in my humble opinion, that the administrations whether it's this one, the one before it, the one after it, uses official means to convey orders and information. And finally, the American public has to become smarter on what they see. You see those interviews on the street where people don't even know that Africa is a continent, not a country. And this is where this information is flowing. So we got a lot of work to do as citizens. Forget the military. Citizens. And then hopefully we'll see a return to, I don't know, baseline intellect when seeing news stories.
You just said that we need to help the citizens, or that we need to focus on that effort first. One of the major things that you are doing right now is preparing to open or to create a school for young men. And let's talk about that for a second. Yeah. So of everything that you could be doing now, why build a school for boys?
Because the data shows that these young men are being left behind. You can pick education, it's significant. You can pick juvenile delinquency, it's even more significant. You can pick social media, where this red pill thing is spreading, and it's like, this is what it means to be a man, which is fake. Pick one. The bottom line is we're losing a generation of young men, and no one seems to think it's a problem. At the same time, we get news that, hey, everybody at 18 is going to be automatically registered for the draft, but the young men you're talking about drafting are not prepared to do that kind of heavy lifting. So trying to start an all-boys school, starting in like 6th grade, going through 12th, because that is the trouble zone. That's where they start to fall astray. That's where society starts saying, okay, these kids, these boys are delinquent. Right there, some proper guidance. And people ask, well, what's the difference with your school? It's like, well, education is one thing. And don't get me wrong, the academics will be rigorous, but it's the character development, the accountability portion of it, the responsibility and the resiliency that young men need to develop. It ain't happening. They're either socially removed in their basements, or they're talking trash about other people, look at women as objects and don't treat them as human beings and don't respect. I can go down this list, but I know this. If World War III breaks out and we have to institute a draft right now, we are not set up like the greatest generation was when they got drafted in World War II. There's a certain level of grit that our kids are missing, especially the boys. There's a certain level of accountability that they have not been held to, in my humble opinion, and we need to change it and show them and mentor them and guide them to push through the adversity, to be a kid that their community can rely on when it does hit the fan. Because to be honest, that's what happened with me, you know, going through schools, having people trust me to develop and to be better, and basically telling me I'm worth it, even though they're kicking my butt. There's something to be said for that. And so in our little corner of the world in Georgia, we're going to try to do that. And hopefully we'll get approved and we'll be able to do it.
What was the moment where you realized if someone doesn't intervene for these boys, society is going to fail them?
Oh, I can tell you exactly when it was. I just got through my command tour in the Middle East. This is what, 22? I'm coming home to Atlanta for the first time in years. And I get off on the exit to go home, and there are four young men selling water, all school age, all should be in school. And I roll down the window, I'm like, hey, why are y'all not in school? They're like, I don't know, why should we be in school? No one cares if we're in school. Why do you care? And I just sat there and stared at these boys, like the light changed, and I'm just staring at them, people going around me honking at them. I'm just like, what happened here? You know what I'm saying? So I go to Morehouse College. I check in. And for those who don't know, Morehouse is all-boys schools where Dr. Martin Luther King went to school, Spike Lee went to school, Samuel L. Jackson went to school. I can go down the list. And I meet with the president of Morehouse for the first time. And he's like, well, you've been gone a while. If you want to fix that problem you saw, the latest you can start educating those boys is about 6th grade, where you'll see a change in them. And he goes, the system has left them behind. And he goes, the system does not care, because the system is the system. And he goes, what's disturbing is, yes, we're talking about young men on the south side of Atlanta, boys of color, but he like, this is spreading. He goes, you got the rich white kids on the other side of town. Go look at their delinquency rates. Go look at how many times they're getting arrested. And sure enough, I did the research. This is a nationwide problem. The girls, I have two daughters, believe me, that's a whole other set of problems. But for the most part, and I mean this genuinely, for the most part, we have to remove obstacles for girls to go, and girls will go get it. motivated, especially at a younger age, they're mature. The boys, we have to literally show them that they need to create goals, motivate them to start pursuing it, surround them with peers that are like-minded, and then mentor them when they get to a certain age before they can actually go do it themselves. That is what the research shows. That's what the data shows. There has been a lot of this that has been studied in the last 5-6 years, and it's revealing we have kind of left them behind, and we've got to play catch up. That's where that moment was and how it led to the genesis of this whole thought process. It's like, in the military, you see a problem. We don't walk past a problem. We figure out a way to address the problem.
If you walk past it, it's like condoning of something. But if you walk past it, you're agreeing that it should exist.
Exactly. And I can't do it.
In your opinion, what does modern culture fundamentally misunderstand about masculinity?
Wow. Well, these are some deep questions. I think modern society, at least publicly, tries to convey masculinity with overt strength, overt strength, not covert strength. What do I mean by that? I mean, I think people say, hey, if you're a masculine dude, you have to be in people's faces. You have to be in the front. You have to have your chest out, and you have to vocalize the toughness you bring, which I think is an absolute fallacy. Perfect example. Take you back to World War II. Out of the 5-star admirals and generals that we had that came out of that conflict, The most understated one, in my opinion, the most effective one was Chester Nimitz. MacArthur talked about how great he was. Halsey talked about how great he was. All these dudes, front of Time magazine, all this kind of just braggadocious, being made into these basically living gods. But the quietest ones, Nimitz, Leahy, very understated, while King and Halsey and all the... Bradley, understated. I can just go down the list. Are they less men? Are they less masculine because they weren't out in front? Blah, 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 blah. No. I have a list of heroes that I had in the military, and Nimitz was one of them. The man took the guys that completely jacked up Pearl Harbor and said, I ain't firing any of you. You guys got to step your game up. We're going to do it. Leadership, while they're trying to raise the battleships from the floor of Pearl Harbor, that's masculinity. Step into a problem, motivate people, goes and solves problems. Meanwhile, MacArthur, who was all in front of the cameras, ran like a true to the game you know what out of the Philippines because he did not listen, and then had us change our entire strategy for him to get his ego back and go back through the Philippines. And we're talking about MPS. Y'all know this. I don't have to tell you that, even though I went to the war college instead of postgraduate school.
Oh, okay.
I'm still bitter about that. But anyway, that's but y'all know this, right? That's, to me, masculinity. Understated quietness. You don't have to brag about it. The Teddy Roosevelt speak softly, carry a big stick mentality. Today in 2026, you've got the red pill movement. You got all these dudes. You've got a certain person that needs a certain department for the United States that's always in front, using all these words about no quarter and all this kind of stuff. What are we doing? That's not masculinity. That's bad cosplay. It's what it is. The average American did not even realize who the Secretary of Defense was until now. I'm talking about going back to McNamara and Vietnam. You couldn't name them because they just sit off to the corner. Your most effective leaders in my generation, like a McRaven, they weren't seeking limelight. Then you look at their resume like, oh my God, this dude's a bad.
Whoopsie.
Right? Masculinity is not bullying. Masculinity is helping others and strengthening them. It's being someone that the community can go to when there is a time of trouble. And more importantly, it is not about breaking down or tearing down anybody else. That's, in my mind, what it is. So if I have a young man that comes through our school, for example, by the time they're done, they're thinking about other people more than themselves. They're looking to help other people other than themselves. And most importantly, they're trying to get better every day, and they're not bragging about what they've done. They're looking to the next thing. That's the way I see it, at least.
That rolls right into my last question about your school, is if your school succeeds beyond your wildest expectations, what kind of men walk out of its doors?
I guess basically a roll up of everything we've talked about in this podcast, to be honest with you. Someone who recognizes that there's a difference between cockiness and confidence. Someone who recognizes the difference between strengthening someone and being strong themselves, but most importantly, someone that people know they can go to, rely on, and follow without hesitation. however that form may be for that individual young man. Maybe they're charismatic. Maybe they're quiet. Maybe they are intellectually unbelievable. Or maybe school was hard for them, but they understand how to read everybody else. Their emotional IQ is through the roof. Whatever it is, they find their best traits. They utilize them to help others. And they continuously work on where they feel like they're weak. And they can do it openly and not be afraid or ashamed that they have something to improve on.
All right. For this last little bit, let's go back to being a little retroflective, talking about Bobby Jones. Mm-hmm. Was there a period after command and then retirement where you had to rediscover who Bobby Jones was without the responsibility and rank attached?
Yeah, I think it's the hardest thing I've had to do. The first 6 months after retirement, I don't know if loss was the word, but not knowing what I'm doing or where I'm going was a big deal. One of the things I think, you know, you go through TPS, TAPS, whatever they call that class now, and they kind of touch on it a little bit, but I don't think the average person who gets out, especially the longer you stay in, realizes how much the uniform becomes part of your identity. And what I mean by that, I'm not talking about, oh, I'm in the Navy or I'm in the Army. I mean the ethos by which you live is defined by it, and how that service defines your thought process, your goals, and what you're going to do. Then all of a sudden, one day you look up, now you have to define it for yourself. And it's hard to define goals when you don't know who you truly are without said mega service and all the input is put into you. And you'll feel lost because you will feel like you don't have a purpose. Even if you say, hey, this is exactly what I'm going to go do. You know, people go, I'm going to school, blah, blah. You're still delaying the inevitable. What are your goals post-military? What are your goals post a career? And this is the other thing that jumped out to me. Because of where I went to high school and stuff, very elite kids, you've been like on pause to civilians. They've gone and done all this stuff on the outside and established themselves, MBAs and blah, blah, blah. And you may have even gotten those degrees while you were still in, but at the same time, they're at middle management, about to assume leadership of Fortune 500 companies and stuff like that. And you're sitting there like, dude, I'm trying to buy clothes so I have an actual wardrobe to go to work and go to interviews in. You know what I'm saying? You're not even thinking. You're starting from scratch.
What do I do when I don't wear a uniform every day?
Yeah. No one's telling you what to wear. But what's interesting about it...
What is my style?
Yes. Right. Because guess what? It ain't what it was 25 years ago when you started this. So you got to redefine all these different aspects of yourself. And at the same time, you see that you're behind your civilian peers and you try not to let it irk you. And then they'll be like, oh, well, you know, you were in the service. Like, I don't know, something was wrong with you. And so you feel like you're kind of behind on that. And that's where you got to find other vets that have already gone through this. It is essential. If there was one thing that TAPS or whatever that class is called now could do, it was like, look, where are you going to be? You're going to be in this section of the country. Here is a network of veterans. You will plug in with them today. So when you get there, they will be waiting on you to help you through the process. That was the initial hard part. Now, I feel like I've definitely found my stride there. But you don't realize how much you gave to the military until you're out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to start over from scratch. And you're just like, geez. To the point where you're like, this is harder than going to boot camp because there's no guidance for it. There's no real manual for it because you are different than each other person that goes and gets out the military, whether it's 7 years, 25 years, whatever, it doesn't matter. So you're starting from scratch, and I think a lot of vets will feel lost, especially that first year. Even if you have a job lined up for you. I remember waking up the next day after I retired, and I was like, why am I waking up at 4:30? Why am I up? You know, and I got up and I just sat on the couch and watched the early morning cable news till 12 because I didn't know what to do. Honestly, I didn't know what to do. So, I mean, that was interesting. But you can work out of it. Like I said, rely on veterans. Try to have a plan. You will deviate from it. But talk to people who've been there before.
What truth about yourself took you the longest to accept?
This is going to be silly to say, but that I genuinely missed the Navy my first few years.
It took you a long time.
Oh, yeah. Because, you know, I'm like, man, because you know how it is when you're in. You're just like, man, I can't wait to get up out this. Yeah, you're like, I'm out, man. I can't wait. Boy, y'all going to miss me when I'm out. Then you're out, and you're like, oh, my God, I missed the Navy. What do I do? What was that scene in Talladega Nights where he's like, what do I do with my hands? I don't know what to do.
I don't know what to do with my hands.
That's how I kind of felt the first few months out.
Mm-hmm.
And it was hard. It was like, okay, the acknowledgement is saying, hey, I miss the Navy. I went to therapy. I did all these things to acknowledge the fact, okay, this is over. This is over. It's okay to miss it. Okay, now that you've acknowledged it, now can we move on? Now can we go do something constructive? I'm in a much better place now, but...
It was difficult
because you didn't want to admit that you actually missed the thing that you've been talking about for 25 years.
The hubris.
You know, a busy sailor is a happy sailor, and all of us, we will talk trash about it, and then we get up like, oh my God, what do I do? You know,
yeah.
So,
trauma bonding at its finest.
Yeah.
If you could sit down with your younger self before the Navy and tell him one thing, what would it be?
I would tell him it's worth it. Everything that you're about to go through is worth it. And you're about to go through a lot, but it's worth it. Because you're going to come out on the other side and you're going to have a very unique perspective on life. You have a very unique perspective on citizenship. You have a very unique perspective on what sacrifice looks like. Because you, your shipmates, battle buddies, whatever you want to call them, y'all going to go through some things. And those experiences are going to shape the second half of your life. And you need to do what you can to make sure those lessons learned are paid for to the next generation. Because they are unique. But yeah, it'll be worth it. It'll be worth it. That's what I'd say.
You spent decades leading, fighting, building, mentoring, and shaping people. What have you learned about what truly changes a human being?
Man, these are some very meta questions. Well, I learned two things. Number one, people in general are inherently good. From the time they're toddlers, they actually want to help other people. Like a toddler will see a toddler fall down, they will help them up on instinct. We are instinctively good. Social conditioning will come in and tell us what we should value, what we shouldn't. That's where things start to get murky. But it doesn't matter what the kid looks like, this and the other. When we're smallest, we want to help one another. We have to remind people of that trait in us. That's number one. So I think we're inherently good. Number two, I saw this firsthand. Even those who are in the most destitute and horrible situations in life, they want, they crave, they starve acknowledgement of existence, and they want to learn. They want to continuously learn. When I was in Liberia and I came across an orphanage that I worked with my entire time there, about my second week there, I was out in the bush, you know, all their parents had been killed in the war, and the kids, you could tell, they weren't starving, but you can tell they hadn't had nutritious food and stuff. So I'm like, hey, I can get y'all some food. Da-da-da. Do y'all have a preference of what you want? What do you want most? And I'll never forget this 14-year-old boy. He said, pencil and paper so we can go to school. They lived in an environment, no power, no central, no nothing. Just they wanted to go back to school. And it hit me like a ton of bricks. These kids ain't worried about eating. They're worried about learning. And so after that tour, every time we would go around and we'd do like Comrail projects and stuff like that, I would always try to find the school and just to see what the mindset was. And all these kids wanted to learn. They wanted to learn. They wanted to learn about me or other people, other societies. And I learned that that is the original hunger. That is the original thirst, to crave knowledge, right? And then, you know, I'd come back home to the United States, and we've been socially conditioned to believe school is a chore. So those two things, the right of just dignity to exist, and we're inherently good, coupled with the thirst and the craving of knowledge, are the two biggest things that I've taken from this whole experience. And I would have never learned that. I would have never thought about it. I would have never seen it had I not been in the Navy. And I think we in America want the same things too. We've just been told and conditioned over decades, maybe even centuries, that it's not as important as chasing like money or something like that. And I think we can be better than that. I think we may have no choice but to become better than that if this experiment is to continue after 250 years.
All right. To wrap up our session, what is the question nobody asks you that they probably should?
Oh, wow. Huh. Why, I guess, is why. Why do this?
And what's the answer?
Well, it's like my brother and I would tell each other, my brother is an Air Force pilot. Well, he just retired, Air Force Academy grad. And we'd say, if not us, then who? Right? And the reason I say why is because when you ask a kid, let's say a 15-year-old girl or boy, what do you want to be when you grow up? They will give you an answer. All of them will give you an answer for the most part, but they won't give you the details on how to become that person. The reason is because they have not really fleshed out the why. They know what the end goal looks like, but they can't tell you the why. When you ask someone why you do something, it forces you to get into the details of the process of becoming what you want to be. And when you do that, you really zoom in and into the motivation. Why would anybody want to spend 9 months away from home on a 500 some odd foot ship going into the most dangerous waterways in the world routinely? Why would you do that? Is it because you believe what the politicians say? Is it because you believe that your country is the most dominant or the best way to do things? Why do you do it? And at the end of the day, my why was because, number one, people did it before me and they did protect me. But number two, after getting into this organization, I did not want friends of mine, people I care about, shipmates that I actually give a damn about to go without me. Because I believe I can help whatever they're doing and they can help me do whatever I'm doing. I just wanted to be part of a team. And as you get older in life, you realize it's hard to be parts of teams, especially teams that matter. And so that's pretty much it.
All right.
The why.
This has been absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much for spending some of your time while you're passing through going to another conference.
Yeah, no, it's fine.
But thank you so much, and we hope to have you back in the future.
I'll be around. Sure. Thanks.
Thanks for joining us in the Trident Room. For more information about today's guests and topics, please visit the show notes online at nps.edu/Trident Room Podcast. The Trident Room Podcast has been brought to you by the Naval Postgraduate School Alumni Association and Foundation. For questions, comments, and suggestions, please email us at Trident Room Podcast Host at nps.edu.